Gutierrez.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Barking up the right tree, Norway's environment minister tells us why his country has eagerly answered Brazil's call for investment in its highly anticipated Rainforest Preservation Fund, and why his government has a duty to throw in a whole lot of green.
And ghost of a chance, the city of Paris launches a lottery that will see the winners pay for the opportunity to be buried alongside its most famous dead people in a bid to improve a grave situation.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. And we receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is from the jazz legend Charlie Parker. This song is called Out of Nowhere. That's Charlie Parker with Out of Nowhere.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
Rule of Trees, Brazil unveils a new plan to preserve tropical rainforests, and Norway's environment minister tells us why his country has pledged billions and why he thinks everyone will benefit.
Hope on hold. A political analyst from Sudan tells us what a ceasefire could mean for her country, but says she's not holding her breath just yet.
Iguana set the record straight. They were derided as an invasive species, but new research suggests iguanas were living on one Mexican island long before humans showed up.
And plot twist. If you win a lottery in Paris, you could be buried among the legends in one of the city's deteriorating cemeteries, but it's going to cost you. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that knows sometimes you have to take one for the tomb. In a way, money does grow on trees, in the sense that there's a lot of money to be made from the rainforests of the world, which is exactly what has made global deforestation so hard to stop. But Brazil wants to flip those incentives around. As COP30 gets underway, the home country of the Amazon has announced a new plan and a new kind of strategy, a fund to pay states to stop felling trees. If the Tropical Forests Forever Facility, or TFFF, fund succeeds, more than 70 heavily forested nations could receive payments. Success is hardly a sure thing, though. The target for the fund is an ambitious $125 billion. But some promises are already coming in, and Norway has already pledged $3 billion to the cause. Andreas Bjelland Eriksen is Norway's Minister of Climate and Environment. We reached him at the Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil.
Minister, what makes this a good investment, this $3 billion for Norway?
Well, tropical rainforests are important to all of us. They store, they save CO2 emissions that would otherwise increase the challenges that we are facing currently all over the world with climate change. But also they are important because of their biodiversity, because a lot of the plants that you find there are important for cancer medicines, for example, that we utilize all over the world. So this is a very good investment for the world, but also for the people of Norway.
And how did your country, your delegation, decide on that number, $3 billion? Because as we speak, and it could change, certainly it was the largest offering for this fund as of yesterday.
Well, Norway has been a country that have been working with the protection of tropical forests for a very long period of time. And then it was about finding an investment figure that was right for us. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to demonstrate that we are committed to support the TFFF, that we believe in this model. I mean, the idea is to create a fund that basically can help protect tropical rainforests in all eternity. And that is exactly what we need. With what's happening to the tropical forests now, just reducing deforestation is not enough. We need figures to go to zero rapidly, and the TFFF can help contribute to that.
This is, we should underline for our listeners, not a donation. It is a contribution that is promising a return. So just map it out for us. How would Norway or other countries who contribute get in exchange for those contributions?
We have dispersed about $5 billion since 2008 to tropical rainforest protection, and that have been donations. And we believe that donations will be important also going forward. But we do not think that donations from public money will be enough alone. We also need to tap into the vast private investments that can help drive the right change that we want to see with respect to climate, with respect to nature protection. And in this case, I mean, by investing, by basically loaning money until 2075, so it's a long loan, we can create a model that makes sure that there are money invested broadly, giving a payback, and that payback can generate a revenue stream to the countries who stop deforestation and who ensure that they have a long-term perspective on preserving tropical rainforests.
The Director General of Brazil's Forestry Service has called this fund a, quote, game changer. They are promising to drum up $25 billion from other contributing nations, and on top of that, $100 billion from private investors. What sense are you getting there about how they are going to achieve that? I mean, are you confident they will be able to achieve those goals?
I mean, if we were not confident that this could work at scale and that we could get more countries aboard, then I don't think that we would have made the announcement that we made yesterday in the first place. But there are still work to be done. There's no doubt about that. And I think more countries need to look at the model, more potential other sponsors as well, look at the risks associated with it, but also all the benefits associated with the TFFF.
What did you see and hear as you made that assessment and, you know, read through all of the points that gives you that confidence? What did you see this time that sold you on it?
I think for Norway, the underlying premise here, which we know very well from our own sovereign wealth fund, is that it is a really smart idea to create a perpetuous revenue stream that can help protect tropical rainforests, not only in the short run, contingent on the money that is being put forward here and now, but also bring in a long-term financial incentive to protect rainforests. And I think that was the most important thing for us. And then there has been conducted a lot of technical work, and we have looked at a lot of that technical work. There is still work that needs to be done. This being a sound financial model and risk being managed properly by the World Bank, who have said yes to managing the fund, that is still important for Norway. But we believe that can be done, and hopefully other countries will see the same.
The fund has earmarked 20% of disbursements for payments to go to indigenous communities. How did that factor into your decision?
I mean, we have been a big supporter on work in indigenous communities, indigenous peoples, for as long as we have been doing work on tropical rainforest protection. So for us, that is a really, really good idea. We know that indigenous peoples are some of the best custodians, guardians of tropical forests. So it's also a very effective way of both ensuring that the tropical forests remain standing, mm-hmm. and at the same time that jobs, opportunities, value creation, economic growth is created in the areas that are located within the tropical forests, and that also need to see sort of a development and prosperity being brought to their regions, but without having to cut down the forests.
And Minister, it's no secret to you, obviously, that Norway has come under fire for pursuing ambitious climate goals, but also still relying heavily on its own oil and gas exports. Is this contribution a way of trying to compensate for that?
No, it's not a compensation for that. We work with the tropical rainforest protection because we believe it's in our own interest and it's in the global interest. And I understand the question, but at the same time, the need to phase out emissions, CO2 emissions from all sectors, including oil and gas, is basically a coordination problem that every country in the world has. And we are working very hard, very closely with the EU, who basically consumes all of the oil and gas that we produce, to do the transition that we need to see going forward, to commit to emission being reduced from all sectors, and to face them as quickly as possible.
Minister, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
Andreas Bjelland Eriksen is Norway's Minister of Climate and Environment. We reached him in Belém, Brazil. In Sudan, there is a glimmer of hope after more than 2 years of brutal fighting and 2 particularly horrifying weeks. After last month's capture of the contested city of El Fasher, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces say they've agreed to a U.S.-backed proposal for a humanitarian ceasefire. The plan was put forward by a mediator group known as the Quad, made up of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. In a statement yesterday, the RSF said it's accepting the deal to ease what it called the, quote, catastrophic humanitarian consequences of the war. Dalia Abdelmanem is a political analyst from Sudan. She fled to Cairo 2 weeks after the war broke out in 2023. That's where we reached her.
Dalia, do you feel that this ceasefire proposal is real, that it can have some lasting impact and actually bring peace?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, as in it's a good step because the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, acknowledge that they will, you know, abide by the ceasefire. And the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, last week said that they agreed to it with certain conditions. However, the caveat is we've been down this road before. We've had so many ceasefires and calls for truce and nothing has ever come out of it. I mean, someone posted on a social media platform X today, they're like, don't hear what the RSF is saying. Look at what they're doing. And already they've continued with their, you know, drone attacks. Yeah. You know, there've been attacks in the capital, Khartoum, and in another city, Atbara. And, you know, violations are continuing in Al-Fashir and in other cities like Al-Ubayid and Bara, which are in the states of Kordofan. So it's a matter of a waiting game. Will it hold? Will they abide by it? How much pressure will be brought onto both sides to ensure that this ceasefire does get implemented and it does hold?
Obviously, those drone strikes that you talked about would need to stop. But what else would you need to see and hear for you to be able to believe that this time is different, knowing what you know and having seen what you've seen?
Number one, safe passage for civilians who are trying to flee and get to safety. We've been seeing and reading and watching horrific reports and videos and testimonies of what people trying to flee to safety have to go through. There was one report I saw yesterday, someone who managed to get out of Al-Fashir, and he was saying once they hit the outskirts, all they could see was dead bodies. And there's been reports from the Yale Humanitarian Lab, and these bodies are being buried in mass graves. So we're relying on satellite imagery to try and gauge exactly what's happening. And the second thing that would prove to me that they are, you know, they will stick to the ceasefire is allowing aid convoys to get through, because these people have, especially the people of Fashir, have been besieged for more than 500 days. That's nearly a year and a half, where they had to, and they ended up eating, you know, animal feed in order to survive. And then that ran out and they literally had nothing left edible in the city. That's another thing.
Why do you think that this proposal and this apparent acceptance of it, despite on the ground, you know, revealing different things, why do you think, Dalia, that this is happening now?
I think pressure has been brought upon the backers of both armies, be it the United Arab Emirates or Egypt or Saudi. And these three countries are part of the Quad, along with the United States, who've been negotiating and trying to reach an agreement. And I think the fact that this has come out and that they've somehow come up with a plan of how, you know, the next steps of, you know, what happens after the ceasefire and what happens next is a positive sign, which means if you have the backers of both these armies in agreement, that means they can also bring about pressure on the two armies, on the RSF and SAF. But how much are they willing to give up? How much pressure will be brought onto them? Will the UAE be told to no longer supply the RSF with arms and weapons? You know, the smuggling of weapons into Darfur from the UAE under the guise of their humanitarian clinics has been well documented. Yeah. So are they willing to stop that? And let's not forget the arms deals are very lucrative. And it's always part and parcel of any war. And that sometimes the economy of war pushes, you know, there's been an arms embargo on Darfur since the 2000s. Why is that not implemented? Why are people who are violating this embargo by the United Nations Security Council not being sanctioned, not being penalized for continuously flaunting this embargo and continuously supplying arms, which are then used on civilians?
The UAE, you mentioned, Dalia, I was going to ask you about that. As you said, widely believed to be supporting the RSF. Last Sunday, you may have seen the UAE's senior diplomatic envoy said the Emirates had been wrong to not impose sanctions on the instigators of the 2021 coup, including the RSF. What value do you put into those words? Do you think the UAE is actually rethinking its position now?
I think the UAE knows how to play the PR and politics game very well. They know what to say, they know what to do, and they have the ability to do both. So I don't believe a word that comes out of any government official, because they say one thing, but then the UAE influencers and their bots are continuously bombarding social media with how, you know, it's the Islamists are killing Christians and it's the Islamist army. There's no denying the role of the Islamists when it comes to SAF. However, at this moment in time, the gravest of violations are being committed by the RSF, which is the military, the army that the United Arab Emirates has used in Sudan and elsewhere, Libya and Yemen to be specific. So, and while they say this, they continue to supply the RSF with arms. So they know what to say and they have the ability to put it out there on all these different formats. But for me personally, no. I don't believe them.
Last week on our show, you know, you mentioned the telecommunications blackout. I spoke to a woman in Washington, D.C., Nadia Tahoe, who was desperate to reach her family members in El Fasher. She had already lost at least two family members at that point and was trying to reach others. We first spoke to you, Dalia, just about 2 years ago, April 2023, when all of this started to unfold. You were able to get out. How is your family doing?
We're lucky. We're fine. I mean, most of my immediate family were scattered. I mean, where all of us are in different places, but we're safe. We have roofs over our head. That feeling of abject hopelessness that you can't do anything. All I can do is offer them my prayers and say, I hope you hear something. And so we don't know. And of course, your mind plays horrible games with you and you just think the absolute worst.
Dalia, I appreciate this. Thank you for coming back on the show. Please take care.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Dalia Abdelmonem is a Sudanese political analyst. She's in Cairo. And an update. Last week, Neil spoke to Nadia Taha in Washington, D.C. She had been desperately trying to reach her family in El Fasher, including her uncle. We heard from Nadia today, and she told us she still hasn't heard from that uncle. But this week, she did learn that another of her uncles had died from exhaustion and hunger just a day after managing to escape El Fasher. People think they're not supposed to be there, but it turns out they are from there. I'm talking about the 100 or so spiny-tailed iguanas on Clarion Island off the Pacific coast of Mexico. Decades ago, scientists agreed they were invasive, they'd been introduced by humans, but there was no science to back that up. So biologist Jacobo Reyes Velasco and his colleagues did some science and found that that assumption was wrong, and iguanas were native to the area. We reached Jacobo Reyes Velasco in Colima, Mexico.
Jacobo, can you describe for our listeners what these iguanas actually look like?
Okay, well, these little iguanas look like little Godzillas. They are dark. They have big scales. They have really long nails as well, and a really long tail.
So they look super friendly.
They look super friendly, yes.
And how do they compare to other iguanas there?
So The main difference between this particular population of iguanas and the reason why we started thinking that this might be quite different from other populations is that they're really yellow. So males have this really nice yellow coloration, while other iguanas in the mainland, they are darker.
Mm. So those yellow iguanas, the special ones we're talking about in this case, what was the prevailing story about them and how they got to the island?
The problem is that there were no actual studies about these iguanas before. So people assume that they were introduced because they didn't really see them before. And there had been a few other researchers that had been to the islands, but they didn't really spend a lot of time there. And they never reported iguanas. So there was nothing really known about this. The thing is that there's only one study that was done about them, and the person only spent about 3 days in the island and didn't report any iguanas. People just ignored and assumed that they were introduced.
Never assume. Never assume. So exactly. What did you and your team have to do to figure out what the real history, what the real story about where these iguanas came from?
Yeah, so I spent a month and a half on this island. I was curious about these iguanas because I've seen a photo of them. So when I spent time with them, I realized that they were really different from the iguanas that we have in my home state. So what we had to do was to look at the DNA of this particular population and compare it to other iguanas across Mexico to see where they could have come from. If they were introduced, where was the closest population from? And what we found was that these iguanas were really different from everything else. It could potentially be said that this is a new species, but we need to do farther research and do more analysis.
But what you're suggesting right now with this research, what you are able to suggest is that they're not invasive at all.
Exactly. We didn't find any close relatives from anywhere in Mexico that would say that these things were introduced from somewhere else. And what we found was that these things had been in the island for at least 700,000 years. So that's older than even humans living in the New World.
Yeah, just 700,000 years. What did you think when you saw that information before your eyes?
I was not surprised, to be honest. My main question is, why did they go unnoticed for so long? Yeah. And it was actually harder for me to convince the other authors on the paper that these things were not introduced. They were really shocked.
So what do you think it was? I mean, you mentioned, you know, it might be harder to get to the island. What did you say to convince your colleagues that this is what was going on?
I found all the other accounts of researchers going to these islands. So researchers started going in the late 1800s. And what I found was that everybody mentions that the vegetation on the island was really, really thick. This is not really a tropical island. So right now you only see mostly grasses and a few scattered bushes. But back in the day, people describe as the vegetation being really, really thick with really, really tall grasses. And the researchers would only spend maybe 1 or 2 days on this island and then they would go away. So I think that because the vegetation was so thick and it was so difficult to walk around the island, these iguanas pretty much just went unnoticed. Mm. But then they introduced pigs and goats in the island and they pretty much completely destroy the original vegetation. So those pigs and goats were later exterminated, but the vegetation, it's really, really different. It's a lot more sparse. It's a lot easier to walk. So I think that might have contributed for people not finding the iguanas before.
There were invasive species, though, or species introduced, as you said, by people, that vegetation being destroyed. And that has, so in one way, it helped you conduct this research and illuminate the history, the real history of these iguanas. But on the other hand, there's concern about preserving the island. So government officials were planning to exterminate these lizards. So is this research, do you think, going to change that plan?
Yes, that's really what I hope. So it was not something they're going to do right away, but it was on their radar. Mm-hmm. So hopefully with this new research, they'll appreciate the iguanas a lot more, and maybe we'll be able to do more research with this particular species.
One of the headlines covering your findings in the New York Times, in fact, they described this as vindication for these iguanas. Do you feel that way? Do you feel responsible
yes.
and proud of this vindication?
Well, I'm very happy. I'm very happy that people actually taking notice of this, and I'm very happy for these particular iguanas. I'm happy, and I hope that this effort will have an actual positive impact on the species and on the other species in the island.
Jacobo, thank you for this.
No problem. My pleasure.
Jacobo Reyes-Velasco is a co-author of a new study on spiny-tailed iguanas in Mexico. We reached him in Colima. Imagine spending eternity next door to Edith Piaf. Or having Maria Callas as your permanent neighbor. Or what if you were able to spend forever next to the Dionysian rock poet Jim Morrison?
Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe.
But if you want to put your coffin down, you'll have to be coffin up, is a slogan that was immediately rejected for being tasteless and nonsensical, and in English. Those are just three of the luminaries buried in Paris in the cemeteries of Père Lachaise, Montparnasse, and Montmartre. You may have left a single rose or a handwritten poem or a half-smoked joint on one of their tombs. The groundskeeper thanks you for the last one. But whichever cemetery you visited, you may have noticed that it appears to be a death's door. The fact is, some of the tombs in these places are in dire need of repair. And to get these repairs done, the city has come up with a plan, as weird as it is. Maybe it's just weird. Paris is holding a lottery. If you win, you get to pay at least 4,000 euros to repair one of the unsightly tombs. Having paid to repair it, you then get a chance to dwell in said tomb. On a few conditions. First, you have to be a resident of Paris. Second, you have to pay anywhere from 1,000 euros for a 10-year lease to 18,000 euros for a permanent lease. And third, you have to be deceased. Probably went without saying, but I don't want any angry phone calls. If you don't meet those conditions, I am sorry to disappoint you. But here is maybe some consolation. It's possible that those cemeteries are full of famous, loud ghosts.
No.
Kind of tough to rest in peace. Here's Spiral Beach with Cemetery. Spiral Beach with Cemetery.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we will head to Powell River, British Columbia, the last stop in our week-long series of hometown editions.
We'll hear about a plan for two hydropower dams that has opened the floodgates to opposition because it would send all the energy they generate to the United States.
And local documentarians explain why some residents want the city to scrap the name Powell River, mainly because the Powell in question was an architect of the residential school system. Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ Ben Frankenstein. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from AW Research Laboratories located in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. Tune in to KAXE's new podcast, The Season Watch Pod, with host Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. A podcast for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New podcasts debut Thursdays. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, Thursday, November 13th. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Friday edition, part two. Coming up.
Final destination. In the last of our hometown editions, we will take you to Powell River on BC's Sunshine Coast.
Balance of power. For decades, two hydro dams have kept the paper mill in Powell River running. But now that the mill is gone, the local First Nation says the power should stay local and definitely not be exported to the U.S.
And a sheltered life. I'll speak with a man who's doing his best to end homelessness in Powell River, though the only shelter in town has shut down and he is unhoused himself.
That's coming up right now on tonight's Hometown Edition. Stay tuned. Powell River was a mill town. In 1912, the Powell River Mill churned out its first roll of paper. And as mill employees moved into new developments, the town began to take the shape of the city we see today. At one point, one in every 25 newspapers worldwide was printed on paper from Powell River. So when the paper business died a slow death a few years ago, it left behind an empty mill site and two hydro dams with nothing to power anymore. Before the town and the mill and the dams, the area was called Tisquat. And earlier this year, in a step forward for reconciliation, the Kla'aman First Nation reached an agreement with the mill owner for the nation to reacquire a large portion of the site. Then in August, the dam's operator applied to the Canada Energy Regulator for a 30-year lease to export the power from the dams to the United States. If that application is approved, Tisquat will be left with no local power. John Hackett is Haygus, or chief, of Kla'aman Nation. That's where we reached him, just north of Powell River.
Haygus, John Hackett, I wonder if you could describe the difference in feeling between when you signed that deal with the mill owner and then the feeling when you found out about this export proposal.
We're very confused because we thought we had a mutual beneficial memorandum of understanding with Brookfield, and it's very discouraging because Kla'aman negotiated for over 5 years to reacquire the industrial mill site that curtailed, and we need the energy to uplift any development that is on the site, not only us but the other investors that invest in the other 200 acres.
There's this photograph in their CBC News coverage from the time of when you that initial signing, and everyone is smiling. And you said at the time that, quote, it feels like a stolen community member has been returned to our home after 150 years. So the land deal isn't going anywhere. But as you've said, you need the power. So does it feel like something's been stolen again?
Yes, it has the same feeling exactly. In 1910, our community members were forcibly removed from the site, and it took generations and generations to get to a point to reacquire 120 acres of the site back. It wasn't the whole site, but just feels like the carpet was pulled out underneath us.
Yeah. You and your community, I know, have been community members, are sending letters, spreading the word about your opposition to this, how you feel about it. I know you've had a conversation with the CEO of Brookfield Renewable North America, Stephen Gallagher. How did that conversation go?
It didn't go well. I reached out to Stephen Gallagher to talk with him about the MOU and just talk about the values that we thought we had a mutual beneficial agreement. And I relayed to him that if the power doesn't get reallocated to the site and all the development opportunities fall through, it could put the site in receivership, and this could cost British Columbia hundreds of millions of dollars. And Stephen said he's moving forward with the application. He just didn't flinch.
We also reached out to Powell River Energy Inc. for a comment. They operate the dams. They're a subsidiary of Brookfield Renewable North America.
Yeah.
They said to us, the statement reads in part, quote, having an export license does not require us to export power and leaves the door open for future opportunities with BC Hydro, the Klamath Nation, or other local partners as they arise, unquote. So they're saying we've applied, but we're not necessarily going to use it. Does that offer any reassurance?
No. We've heard a lot of words like that before, and it's just we've been messed over too many times to put any faith in those words or their statement.
There are supporters, other communities and other First Nations as well. North Island Powell River Conservative MP Aaron Gunn, Powell River Mayor Ron Wasnow, City Council are also being vocal about their opposition. And our listeners are going to hear later in the show, you know, from documentarians who've made a film about a potential name change in Powell River and what happened in 1910 and 1911 when people were forced out to make space to build these dams. I raise that because they talk about how divisive that suggestion of the name change is. Our listeners will hear that. But there's a lot of unity on this issue. So does that give you hope that alignment will put a stop to this?
Yes. Klamath's intention is to have a positive working relationship with the municipality of Powell River. And we're grateful that they are in alignment are concerned with the export of the power to the United States.
BC Hydro as well, we should tell our listeners, has submitted to the energy regulator their opposition, its opposition to this proposal, and is offering to purchase the power. They seem to be caught off guard by this as well, saying, we could use this. Why are you sending it to the United States potentially? Would that move, you know, if BC Hydro were to keep the power in the country, would that be a win?
Yes, I think that would open the door for Klum to negotiate with BC Hydro to allocate the power to the site for development. I think those conversations would go a lot more smoother with BC Hydro other than Brookfield. It just feels like our voice is not heard with Brookfield, and just really our nation is really considering pulling away from that MOU and canceling it.
And what would that mean?
That our relationship would be severed, I think.
So in the meantime, you wait for the energy regulator's decision. When might that come?
We're patiently waiting, and we're looking at the history of Canada energy regulators, and they have a rubber stamp, and usually the turnaround is very quick. But with all the letters that are submitted and the opposition, the decision has stalled. So I find that as a good sign of our voices are heard, and time will tell us if that's true.
Hey, Gus-John Hackett, I very much appreciate this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your attention on this. It's much appreciated.
John Hackett is Hey Goose of Klamath Nation, and that's where we reached him. Tonight in Powell River, temperatures will drop into the single digits Celsius, and unhoused people in the city have no shelter to go to get out of the cold. Powell River's only shelter was shuttered in March. A new temporary shelter is expected to open this winter, but no opening date has been set yet, so volunteers are having to fill in the gaps. Every night since the shelter closed, unhoused people can get dinner courtesy of a local meal train. It's organized by the Cathet Coalition to End Homelessness, an organization completely run by volunteers. Dwayne Patalik is one of those volunteers. He has lived in Powell River since 1984. Right now, he's living there in a tent. We reached him at work at the overdose prevention site in Powell River.
Dwayne, how are the preps for tonight's meal going?
I think it's starting to collect up people bringing in some food here today. They're starting to come in right about now, actually, usually around this time.
The volunteers?
Donations are coming in and that, so it's not too bad. It's slowly but surely.
Do you know what'll be on the menu tonight?
I believe it's going to be, I think it's going to be soup today.
Yeah. Still early in the day, like you said, donations just coming in.
Yeah, some people, you know, they cook up and make homemade soup and stuff like that.
Oh, that must be so appreciated. How many people are served on any given day? How many people come to have dinner?
From 15 to 30.
So this all happens at a spot, and I was looking at your coalition's Facebook page about the dinners. It happens at a place called the Clubhouse, but our listeners should know it wasn't always that space. It used to be a dog pound. So how have you and your fellow volunteers adapted to help people and get this space to fit your needs?
We all came together and cleaned up the dog pound and made it work for us, and It seems to be working. It's a little small, but we get by.
And you've had to put on this meal train since the shelter closed back in March. So can you tell our listeners what that shelter closure means for you and other people?
It meant lost service, dinner for them every night. Yeah. And then it would be people who were feeling safe. They got a place to stay inside and indoors and that. And they felt a lot more comfortable and safer by having that, and there's a lot more problems now without the shelter. It's not very good, actually.
Like what kind of problems?
There's just lots. There's tents are catching on fire, people getting robbed, and it's just a little bit more vulnerable to the people. They're out living in the bush around the Powell River.
Our listeners heard that there's no opening date set yet, but a temporary shelter is supposed to open this winter.
Yeah.
Just tell our listeners, I mean, volunteering is part of your day, but you have a lot of other things on the go. Can you tell us what a typical day is like for you when you wake up?
I start up about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I go to about 11 o'clock at night. And I'm donating my time. Up at the clubhouse and that.
So you're staying in a tent. We should let our listeners know. How long have you been living there?
For probably about off and on for a year now, I guess. Mm-hmm. I just get up and ready to go to work.
How do you squeeze in the volunteering?
I get in there and just do it after work. I get going, so do what I can.
As much as you're comfortable sharing, Dwayne, mm-hmm. What happened in your life?
I've had a few problems with the drugs and that. And I was, married and had kids and that. And empty nest happening. And we kind of went our own way. Yeah, and then I ended up having a stroke. And that went away from my regular job and finances. And I was off for probably about 2 years. And then I just start working, hanging around with an OPS here, and they asked if I wanted a job, and here I am a year later.
It's a situation a lot of people can relate to, that domino effect, certainly, and mm-hmm. we've been speaking about it on our show in other conversations as well. The shelter that I mentioned, the temporary shelter that is supposed to open in the winter, there are people who are opposed to it. What do people say to you when they see you in the street?
They're angry and upset. There are some bad apples out there, you know, do some crime and stuff and that, and they're scared to have that in their neighborhood. And it's kind of difficult for people to try to defend the people that are actually, you know, aren't doing any crime and just trying to live and have a place to stay, right? So
what kinds of things do they say to you?
There's things like, you know, they're, you know, a bunch of lazy homeless people. They're no good for nothing. Druggies and stuff like that. Stuff where I can't say on the radio, I guess.
How do you deal with all of that, Duane? You're a person from Powell River. Yeah. To now face that kind of response from other people in your community, how do you deal with that?
Well, they slander me and I say, well, I do go to work. I work and I get up every day in the morning and go to work. So you shouldn't talk like that about people you don't know what's going on with, you know, what's going on with those people, right?
Well, Duane, I hope that the dinner service goes well tonight. I really appreciate this.
Yes, it's been really nice talking to you.
Duane Patalik is a volunteer and board member with the Kathet Coalition to End Homelessness. We reached him in Powell River. Powell River might not be there for much longer. I don't mean the city will vanish. I mean the name will. The city is named after Israel Wood Powell, British Columbia's first superintendent of Indian Affairs and an architect of the residential school system. Since 2021, the Kla'ama Nation has been working with the city to consider a name change. So far, though, the only result is a deep divide in the community. Kla'ama directors Eileen Francis and Evan Adams have been filming the process. Next year at the Kathet International Film Festival, they'll premiere their documentary, Tumquathnun, which means namesake. Here's a bit of the trailer.
Within the Kla'aman community, opinions vary regarding the town's name. Some see it as reflective of the town's racist and colonial past, while others are optimistic that a name change is inevitable. It's not a matter of if, but when.
We reached Eileen Francis and Evan Adams just north of Powell River on Kla'aman traditional territory.
Evan, that was just a bit of your voice from the documentary there. And so much of it is about the importance of a name and the meaning that a name holds. What does Powell River mean to you?
Well, Powell River is in our territory, and I've heard Powell River all my 60 years. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful town. However, it is named after Israel Powell, someone who Indigenous peoples really hate. He was one of the architects of the residential school system. We wanted to talk in our film with people about, like, the possibility of a name change. What about using traditional place names in our own territories?
And Eileen, what was the moment that you decided what was unfolding there could or should be a documentary? Why did you think telling the story in this way was so important?
So much has been shared and so much opinions have come forward and people's emotions, and both the positive and the negative. I thought it was going to be a quick process, but it just kept on lengthening and lengthening. 5 years later, we're still here, and we've gathered so much material that we thought, why not create a documentary?
Yeah. And Evan, the length of time that Eileen was referencing gives our listeners a sense of the divisions about trying to change this name. How would you describe how that is playing out?
Well, I think we were surprised by some of the discussion. We thought we were talking about a name change, and it started to be about some very racist tropes, like, Did residential schools really happen? Right. Do Indigenous people truly have their own knowledges? Indigenous people cost a lot of money. Why are we listening to them? And I wondered if it was like a microcosm of what's happening across the country, because certainly there are other First Nations and Indigenous groups who are saying, why don't we use our own words and languages and place names where we live? But I was also really surprised and warmed by how many allies and supporters there are, that there are a lot of Canadians, it seems, or local peoples who thought, yeah, why don't we use traditional place names? Yeah, why aren't we friendly, you know, and neighborly between our communities? Why can't we talk about difficult subjects like race and culture and colonialism? So that was a really nice surprise. And I think my standard for allies is much higher.
And Eileen, I'm sure you're well aware that, you know, people listening across this country or the U.S. or around the world, you know, certainly even in here in Canada, they might be learning about Powell River and its history for the very first time. Or, you know, I grew up in British Columbia, but it makes you think about what you were taught and what you were not taught. So ultimately, what do you hope people who were unaware of all of this take away from your film?
I hope they realize that we're not trying to rewrite history. It can't be erased. That brings more of our history to the open, because a lot of Indigenous history wasn't taught in the school systems. And so I hope people, they're open to listening and learning, and they're not just an audience member, but they are a witness, just like how we have in ceremony, we have witnesses. And so I hope they take away a little bit of something from this film.
And the premiere is going to be at Canada's oldest movie theater there. Mm-hmm. I'll ask you both this, but Eileen, what does it mean to you for the premiere to be there?
I've grown up at the theater. My mom just worked down the road from it. And so I remember going there as a 5-year-old.
Oh.
And so having it there, but also like hearing stories of my grandpa walking to the theater and walking back, because the theater was segregated until the 70s.
Until the 70s?
Yeah. And so if the balcony was full, he wasn't allowed to go in, so he had to walk back home. And so it's a real like full circle moment that now we'll have a community screening where citizens of the city, community members of Flamin, we'll all gather and we'll see this film, and I hope that this entire region feels seen and that I've honored them as best as I can, and to show the place that I've grown up, that I represented it well.
Yeah, that's incredibly moving, Eileen. Evan, for you to have the premiere there?
My father talked about going to that theater in town. They would walk several kilometers to get there. This is in the 1940s. He would go with his grandmother, who was born in 1888, mm-hmm. to go to that theater. Yeah, it was segregated. And he talked about being a teenager and how he once had a white girlfriend, and how they resisted the segregation and they sat together and they got in trouble. Anyway, Our film, you know, might have premiered at a few different places, but we're so happy it's happening at that theater in our territory with our friends and our allies and our relatives. I think it has, you know, it's really got, it's a nice feeling.
Oh. Evan, Eileen, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Eileen Francis and Evan Adams are the directors of the film Tom Quoth Nun, or Namesake. We reached them in Kla'aman. The documentary will premiere on March 6th at the Kathet International Film Festival.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
And it is 7 o'clock.